Hello, everybody. Hi. Hiya. Thanks for... We should get started. Thanks for coming along. My name's Barry. I work for Erica F. Howard Slater. What was I going to say? So, when we were thinking about doing this event, then I suppose we wanted to try and engage... I come from a background in experimental music, I suppose, and I have a concern about its usefulness or the ways in which it might say something to the world. And when we were thinking about trying to engage with like the black radical tradition or with jazz or free jazz or something, then I guess in doing an event in Glasgow, you have to recognise, which is in Scotland, which is in Europe, have to recognise that we're in a different context and a different situation from the histories and commitments and traditions of that tradition. So when thinking about that, like a really important thing for me was to try and think about this event in a way that we could be situated here, and how we're not focusing or turning into an exotic object, that tradition, but instead looking at it for some of the ideas and practices that it has, and thinking about whether we have similar practices or similar concerns in Scotland or in Europe or whatever. So that's why the event's called Freedom's a Constant Struggle. It's about these kind of concepts of freedom and how we might have something, how we might think about that locally and how that relates to ideas in the black radical tradition, where we might find common ground or where we might differ. One of the things when we were putting the event together was really helpful. We've known Howard for a few years now, and his texts, he's been writing since, when did the listeners operate? Like 2009, maybe?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so he's been writing these texts since 2009, which I think they don't try and explain the black radical tradition. They don't try and offer necessarily, I think what they do is try and situate some of the themes and concerns within it in a context that Howard and I might come from, that many of you in this room might come from, in the philosophical traditions, the political traditions of the UK, of Europe. So it was really a really good thing to do for us within the context of this weekend, is to try and use that as a way to kind of like not just focus on to focus on the kind of ideas within that tradition, to focus on how they might play out here, how we might kind of like play that song with like different notes or something, I suppose. So we've handed out, on Friday we handed out all of the third listener is operator text, and I don't know if many of you got a chance to read it in the bath, perhaps. It's not homework, you can read it afterwards as well if you like, but we're going to try and talk through some of the ideas within it, try and have a conversation and unpack those a little bit. So I guess the first thing is maybe you could tell us a little bit about those texts and...
Yeah. I guess I've been writing and exploring music for quite a long time. And the... I guess the method of it would be somehow to use a desire communicated in the music and what Deleuze and Guattari would call a desire in perception, mm-hmm. that somehow the music starts off in me like a kind of open field. I don't know how to describe it, but it in writing about music, I try to stay away from too much factual thing and try to use not only the sounds but the concepts of musicians themselves. Mm-hmm. Like even today you could say, well, say two themes we're going to talk about are like a refrain, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or a note, and if we can blow that note a little, mm-hmm. then it's playing with the concepts that the music's bringing out, but the concepts are effects as well. So, but I would say in relation to Fred's book, mm-hmm. one phrase that I underlined when I was reading Fred's book was about the you know, an impassioned response to a passionate utterance, and that sort of stood out for me amongst other things in Fred's book, is like that could, in Fred's language, you know, to join with Fred in his phrase, mm-hmm. to bring his phrase here as an assemblage, like that is how I would explain approach to writing about music. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There is to be responding to something passionate, mm-hmm. not necessarily responding to something that is a knowledge, mm-hmm. not responding to music as statistics, data, that sort of stuff. So, yeah.
I think that, so like that line, an impassioned response to passionate utterance, I think that kind of brings in like the voice or something, mm-hmm. and but also an idea of like how, so I think that music is one of the means by which we communicate, so how we like, you know, how we engage with the world, and therefore it should be a means by which we can say something, you know, how we can speak. So this kind of idea of an utterance, I think it plays into one of the really big concepts that comes out in your writing, which is from Nathaniel Mackie, and which is really useful in Fred's book as well, and one of the real kind of like cornerstones of me being able to think about, one of my concerns, I suppose, is that you have in experimental music, in the as I've engaged in it, there's this kind of like disjunction or disavowal of the politics, or often there's a kind of a reification, it turns it into an empty kind of aesthetic object. There's a line in a Baraka book, actually, that says that kind of like style without any like anything at stake is wanting, I think, wanting the sea without its awful roar. It's a really nice line. Mm-hmm. So, but this kind of like utterance, this what it is that we can say or something, and who we're speaking to, this kind of like goes into this idea of, Nathaniel Mackie has this concept of telling, something being tellingly inarticulate, by which, yeah. I kind of mean that, like, that seems to focus on the, what is that, like the way in which the black musical tradition focuses on or foregrounds moans, stutters, slurs, slurred notes, things that aren't immediately articulate or understandable to a kind of a dominant white social order or something. So that's a big thing in your writing. And
That has been threaded through all three, because I came across that phrase secondhand, mm-hmm. from a book called Bluetopia about Ellington Sumrall and Anthony Braxton. So in a way, it kind of like, I haven't read Nathaniel's book, but there was this phrase, this refrain inside another book that said, tellingly inarticulate. And I guess it kind of feeds back a little bit to the intro, to the sequence of writing, in that really it's an exploration of like music in and of itself is revolutionary. Mm-hmm. That there's always been this tension with writing and sound. And, you know, I have a stutter myself at times, and some sort of sense of playing certain, at the moment, like jazz music, and thinking that there is something here. There is something here that doesn't make jazz, as William mentioned yesterday, a little bit like a reserve that's becoming sort of extinct or whatever. There's actually like so much inside the jazz tradition and the radical black tradition that, because it's not put in the discourse of the West, and we could talk about situationists, we could talk about Marxists, we could talk about all these almost, they bring a whole lot of dichotomies along with them, and some of these sort of dichotomies don't seem to trouble the jazz sound. And I suppose we're moving a little bit to like that notion of collective assemblage of enunciation, but tellingly inarticulate, for me, it was like it's totally political. Mm-hmm. Utterly political, because I think one of the problems, and I could speak from sort of autobiographic, one of the problems I've encountered would be something I'd say called, or I'd nickname, textual psychosis. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it's one of those refrains to try and explore, but I would say it means a certain disassociation from emotion, mm-hmm. and effect, emotion and feeling can be differentiated interestingly. Mm-hmm. And I think, where was I? Textual psychosis. So the sort of experience of like a distance, mm-hmm. you know, you spend reading time, reading, blah, blah, and it can be kind of like a disassociation. Well, intellectual defence. So we'll say when I was in therapy, it would be one of the things I had to work on was intellectual defence. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like I could always have an answer. I could always find a theory for this or that, but I could never get to, you know. So the writing is using this these sort of experiences to try and unlock something else. But to find that, like, one thing I think that has been sort of missed out or occluded in the sort of left disc revolutionary theory is, like, how do people express themselves? You know, like, why isn't there a sort of more pronounced struggle about the means of expression? You know, like...
I mean, I think that there's like a thing, you know, who do you want to have meaning to? Who do you want to speak to? If you want to be recognised, do you want to articulate, like Baraka was talking about it yesterday, if you want to articulate your own situation, then what's the language that you use to do that? And who is it that you want to understand that? So why would you want to be, you know, maybe conventional articulate speech isn't sufficient for saying what needs to be said, or maybe that you don't need to, you wouldn't want it to be understandable to a certain...
One sort of block you might get into with Nathaniel's phrase telling inarticulate is that it's almost surmising or proposing a form of articulacy, seamless articulacy. And in some senses, for me, that seamless articulacy is that, you know, we see a slick production, you know, this slickness that, you know, is kind of more a property of a commodity. Like, how do you disarticulate a commodity? You know, how do you disarticulate the self as a commodity, as human capital? You know, it's like, and the reason, one of the seems to me is that you foreground being inarticulate. Foreground that which is not acceptable in the slickness. So I had a little joke to myself, like, you know, there's always talk of recuperation. You know, this cultural moment can be recuperated, but you think, well, free jazz. Would that ever be on an advert? Like Albert Isler, would it ever sell a car? You know, so I mean, without getting too embedded into other dynamics of free jazz, but to return to this tellingly inarticulacy, and one thing at that time, it's 2008, 2009, before I really started to explore jazz, what would come to mind for me was punk. Right, what would come to me was Fall, the Fall Mark Smith, literally saying, let's get this thing together, let's get this thing together and make it bad. So I could then sort of find a foothold in this refrain. Again, bring it back to a form of experience of music. You know, garage bands, you need three chords, it's not fully produced, you have a goal. So there is, then I'd say, another facet of this open telling the articulacy would be sort of recalling listening to music, and like there's one I could think of as Miles Davis and about Off the Corner, I always remember this one. It's about 55 seconds in on the second album, and there's a synth sound. It just goes, woof, you know, it's in the side of the thing. It's like woof, like this, and it's like, why the fuck do I like that? So what is it? What the fuck is in there? You know,
because,
why?
Because it's trying to articulate something to you, but...
It's trying to articulate the unarticulatable. And then, you know...
So that's the same with, like, growls and humming and moans and nonsense and lyrics
I mean,
and...
There is, I've got a crib sheet here, and Baraka has mentioned this, so it's called the blue notes, but Baraka in one of his books has mentioned it, tones that seem rebellious. Or I've got other, what I liked in the techno days was to say, like, the timbre, the timbre was dirty. And there's a Jelly Roll Morton song, Dirty, 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 you know, so, and it sort of all links up. I mean, I've got a phrase here, if I don't know where, a sound that isn't accordant, a non-accordant sound, is tellingly inarticulate.
Because, like, to have a concert is to, you know, so it's a non-concert in some way, like, it's the opposite. A concert is like an agreement or something, so it's like a non-agreement.
But it's disconcerting, you know, that is disconcerting, but, like, you know, to play harmonica in a glass, uh-huh. like it says on the sleeve notes to a Benny Morton album, to be Bubba Miley putting things down your trumpet. It's almost, it's a search for the note, but it's, and the note, thanks to Weddell Leo Smith saying to me that I could have played 40 B flats. Mm-hmm. You know, like the note can expand, but also it's like the space between the note, mm-hmm. that which doesn't exist as a note, that I think in jazz plays this, it becomes apparent. And to me, then the next sort of, well, first we've got this struggle to the means of expression, mm-hmm. and a staging of that struggle. And Wadada spoke very eloquently yesterday afternoon about the struggle for him to play. Mm-hmm. You know, like there is a physical and emotional struggle. Mm-hmm. And so in that moment for me, there is the founding of the struggle for means of expression, that sometimes the Western discourses we get immersed in, they take us away from that struggle and we hone it down into almost sort of polemical, rhetorical shit between mm-hmm. each other.
Yeah.
You know, and somewhere along the line, the binding agent, the effect, or Anthony Braxton, I'm thinking affinity dynamics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anthony Braxton, another phrase, would use like for more the ensemble. Mm-hmm. There's affinity dynamics. Why down the line down here, you know, is the, you know, getting a little bit onto the ensemble, is the dissension, negativity, mm-hmm. and then down at this other line, down at the, well, let's call it the bottom, if we're talking about a discourse hierarchy, mm-hmm. you know, like down here, there is effect, and effect is unnameable. So effect is like, if a feeling has a word for it, if an emotion is more a somatic body expression, an effect is that which doesn't have feeling, language mm-hmm. for it. So it's the slur, you know, see how, you know, and that very thing could be, well, to use a Western philosophical word, phoné, the sound of suffering. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like phoné versus logos, you know, to really dig the Western myself into the hole. But it's useful because the phoné is rejected from the polis. It's rejected from politics.
It's something that's rejected out of by polis, you mean like the society?
Yeah, yeah. You know, asylums, it's set for somewhere else. But I think some of, with hindsight now almost, you know, I say with hindsight, like because of being locked in a kind of Western Marxist theoretical anarchist tradition, you know, I almost feel guilty for like, why not study the Black Arts Movement sooner? Why not look at the women's liberation movement sooner? Because it's like, I feel, as well as with jazz, there's some sort of key there. Mm-hmm. You know, like the phoné, the sound of suffering in a consciousness-raising group is foregrounded. The sound of suffering is foregrounded in the music.
I think there's like a line up or something about how like musicians, maybe I have it written down here, how musicians do to the melody what's been done to them. Like, so like a social handicap becomes a... reports on having, you know, it's translated or transcended or something, and it's a means by which to express that.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of summons to mind the way that the standard song is transformed throughout jazz, from the, you know, New Orleans, the big band, until Charlie Parker, and then it starts freeing out. So the song, so Coltrane can do a few of my favourite things and only sound, and only do the melody for 2 seconds, you know, 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a kind of a resistance. Mm. I'm just looking at the crib sheet again here, but... like there's other, I think this telling an articulate, if you are in the struggle for the means of expression together, mm-hmm. then that's a different sort of thing. So there's an element of relationality around effect, because if effect can't be named, mm-hmm. then you have to learn how to communicate what you mean. And if you can't play a trumpet, if you can't slide down the bass to get that space between the note to articulate this or find the language, then there's a struggle, and that struggle implies mutuality and relationality.
So one of the things in that I find really interesting in that, coming from like a musical background that I would come from, I have a deep kind of like alienation from notions of self-expression or soloing or something. I'm very uncomfortable with a lot of experimental music in the ways that it kind of, like, you know, you maybe think that it proposes some kind of like or like an idea of freedom as a freedom to do, you know, a freedom to do whatever you might like, rather than a freedom from or a collective kind of freedom or something. And so one of the things that I found in reading your listeners' operator text is this really nice idea of, instead of being like an individual within a collect, you know, an individual or individualizing, there's an idea of maybe being like singularizing within a like an ensemble or within a tradition. So there's an idea of having to know your kind of history and know your tradition and have something to say about that. And that's not the same as kind of soloing or self-expression. It's a mode of kind of communication or even sort of investigation or something. And you were able to kind of put that in those texts into, you know, I suppose maybe a language that I would understand more from like a kind of a European philosophical sense or something. So maybe you could kind of say something about that.
I guess that's the sort of other area of like total applicability of jazz in some sense. I don't know, I think I wanted to sort of almost talk about this inarticulacy just thing in the sense of like I guess like the sort of free jazz being advert. And it's like this
like
idea that
if
you get this thing together and make it bad, does it insulate itself against being recuperated? Does this thing that you cannot describe, this effect, or this emotional state, this sliding note, does it also sort of imply some sort of energy? And it's like can they take that energy, you know, that sort of thing? Or if it is taken, that's like the final straw, almost. If they take the undefinition, then begin to define it, you know, put a language on it, you know.
But so certainly in experimental music in the West, you see these processes of like that are quite reactive or conservative or something. So are you saying, so like there would be like a, I think that like all these avant-garde art forms I'm interested in, they come out of a social context, they respond to a social context, they have some kind of proposition that they make. Okay, so maybe we're in a very strict defining kind of a situation, you want to exceed those barriers, or perhaps you want to kind of overcome them or something, and that led to I suppose noise music in Japan or something. It's this kind of idea of excess or superabundance or something. But it's also very easy for those things to just become these empty styles, and for the means, like there's maybe like a conceptual core to them, and then they get, you know, in order to like live up to this kind of political or social proposal. Amelia, honestly. To live up to this kind of proposal, they come up with a bunch of tools. And so these tools are maybe like aesthetic ways of doing something, and that might be a way of performing or being in a space or doing something. But you do see that happening with a whole bunch of other art forms, where it's a radically political kind of means of embodying like a situation, like an aesthetic, like a language or a habit or a gesture or something. It becomes the way that we communicate a kind of a collective politics or something. But it's becomes recuperated, or there's a conservative process that grabs it very quickly. You know, you're talking about punk, but like the punk that we're left with today, and you know, in the mainstream is like Virgin Records and entrepreneurial, you do it yourself, can very easily turn into, you know, self-promotion and entrepreneurialism or something. But what is it in jazz that's not recuperable?
Well, I say that it's there in certain punk records as well. You know, like there is an energy of sharing, an energy of exploring that which you do not know together. You know, and wanting to communicate, a desire to communicate, a desire not to take power in some sense, the sort of anti-careerism of punk bands. There's a big, you know, history of politics in jazz about those that, you know, and those that don't, and how can, you know, everyone get a gig? And I suppose the whole free jazz thing of like moving to Paris, like the Art Ensemble, as you call it, that we had before, there's no home. For free jazz, then there's a do-it-yourself with the loft scene, some royalties on label. So there are these sort of
I think Daniel that we saw playing last night is a good example of that. I've never, like, in that, you know, he's played with so many people, he's been around for, you know, an incredible musician, but he's always, I find, like, he's always resisted being like a, being a leader or taking any kind of responsibility over the other people that he would be with. And maybe he's not so famous as some other people because of that, but I think that's a political statement.
Yeah, definitely. There's, I suppose I'm in a bit of a quandary because I can see that refusal to take power. And if you think of Duke Ellington or Sun Ra and the sort of sense from our sort of Western perspective that they're the big bosses in control, you know, like they do what Sun Ra tells them, they do what the Duke tells them. But, you know, when you think about John Gilmore stayed with Sun Ra. You know, he could have, you know, solo albums, etc. But he was happy to stay there. So I'm trying to build a sort of tension between a sort of sense of like almost a new form of ensemble being together to live together, like Ra's ensemble live together. So versus that thing of like, well, you don't become the leader. Undermine that sense of power. Maybe you retain the undefinable, the effect, or that is a motivation, a kind of a emotional struggle that ongoes, and that can be attempted to be articulated, continually attempted to be articulated.
And is it something about knowing your kind of context as well, though, or knowing the tradition of which you come from, or the struggle that you're involved in, or something? Like there's a difference between being able to make a modest contribution or to like a struggle or like a context or tradition. So, and that's that, you know, that's obviously as one person you make that contribution, but there's I guess there's an overarching kind of idea as to.
Well, I think this is kind of the problem that thinking about the jazz ensemble can help to solve, because I think something in the language or something in the theory that's perpetually trying to overcome dualism, mass, individual, mass, that one it really holds back, because I think there's a sort of you know, that let's be quite dichotomous ourselves about it. Like, if you're not in the mass, if you're not in the struggle, you're an individualist. Mm-hmm. It's almost a 30s frame of bourgeois individualist. Mm-hmm. You know, if you or an individualist, artist, or whatever, you know, artist critique is like the individualist, they're not socially embedded, they're not in an ensemble, they steal, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, it doesn't seem. I don't know. I suppose again, I'd probably refer to Blues and Guattari again. You know, like what helped me think about the Art Ensemble of Chicago, the ensemble, is this phrase of theirs, like a refrain, the collective assemblage of enunciation.
So, what does it explain that a little bit?
It's like, again, I'd say it's like what Sonia said yesterday. Which I can't remember, about the solo, we're all soloing, or...
Oh, and there needs to be a bass underneath it.
Yeah, but the sense of, like, the... I guess there is no... I don't know, it's quite general, but it really feels like there is no personal statement. No, there is no purely individual utterance. That every utterance is an assemblage, you know, is made up of other things. You're inhabiting the language, other people, the sort of your multiple components of the self, then the different forms and modulations they're taking.
And
so that to me would be a kind of explanation-ish of what is singularity. So this in this thing, like through the ensemble you can singularize, you know, which in another language is through the mass you can individualize or individuate. But this notion of singularity is itself linked to an ensemble. It's linked to, say, component, let's just say, the components of the self, mm-hmm. or of the struggle to understand the effect that is unutterable, or it doesn't find words. Mm. So through, you need the assembly, you need the collective, the ensemble, mm-hmm. to have some fruition through as a singular thing. Mm-hmm. But without having that shit like, well, you're just doing your own thing. You're not on the, you know, joining in with reading off the hymn book, you know.
Yeah, is it a recognition maybe of like, so what you're talking about, so I can understand it, is, you know, maybe like our, I very definitely think that our, like, you know, our selfhood or our personality or something is constructed and forced upon us. You have all these social norms which dictate, you know, our desires and our habits and the ways that we might think, as much as just like, you know, or our gender or race or something like that. And these, like Nathaniel Mackie has a really good term for this. It's kind of like discrepant engagement. It's like an engagement with the between the these kind of like social norms that would like restrict you from that program you like a script, you know, that you're reading off of that you're not even aware of. The discrepancy between that and the kind of emotion or the agony or the effects that aren't allowed within those norms or something. And I think that's what you're kind of talking about, this expression of like being able to kind of articulate something that's not recognizable to those social norms, and yeah. and the means by which to do that, it's still recognizing that they're still constructed but within an alternate sociality or something, like an alternate
a
sub-public or a counter-public or something.
I don't know, but I think it was yesterday, again, this thing of the ensemble, you create a context mm-hmm. for that to happen. And it's almost like, in the attempt to singularize, maybe you don't have an object or an aim in mind. Mm-hmm. Maybe the aim and the object within the ensemble, if I imagine myself playing in the Art Ensemble of Chicago, I am, it's like, well, what do I, again, it's this thing in the jazz tradition, the black radical tradition, is you don't go to the pool of the night, you add to it. I think Richard Mual Abrams, from one of the founders of the ASM, saying, well, you add to the culture. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a totally different way of like, you pioneer the culture, you become at the top of the tree of the culture, Verso release all your books and you're on the top of the, you know, it's like, no, you add to it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that sense of like, that gives a sense of security. In some senses, it holds the process of singularizing through, you know, it is not a million miles away from a therapeutic situation.
Mm-hmm. In what do you mean by that?
Well, like in the sense that there is a certain ensemble holding. There is the therapist and there is the supervisor. There may be group supervision. If it's a group analysis, then that comes to the group to try to hold.
Like from personal experience, are you?
A thing called group process.
Right.
So, and this triggered thoughts about the ensemble as well, and like the way that if this sound of suffering can be articulated within the ensemble, then we really got a different, sounds a bit grand, but like for me, a different political paradigm than what we're dealing with now. Mm-hmm. You know, like the very strict forms of organisation in which elements of fauna and struggle seem to be sort of relegated to the therapist room. You know, it's like, it's rather than like, actually, we're organising as anarchists, communists, socialists, in order to alleviate suffering, and we can't even fucking talk about our own suffering mm-hmm. together. We can't be vulnerable, you know. And like, you know, you listen to certain tracks or whatever, and fucking vulnerability is them. You know, and it's literally there in your ears. It's close, mm-hmm. you know.
And you think that's still possible? That isn't something that's kind of been recuperated or turned into an empty kind of gesture or something?
Depends on how it's done, like anything else. Any you know, jazz gets professionalised in its way. Therapy gets professionalised in its way. You know, that's part of a struggle, is to create these ensembles, these for a fucking enunciation to take place, mm-hmm. you know,
a space in which to be able to say something that isn't.
Say something or express some. Yeah, just that. It's kind of like a. It's kind of really untrendy in the art theory world, where you know, like you said, like expression is just to be you know, some bourgeois self-expression. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's totally different. I don't know, I feel like it's... talking like what Haraka says, I know you're getting many main drops, but like basically a part of the afternoon, Haraka's saying, well, we've got to redefine what it means by humanity. You know, it's a grand statement, but I agree with it. It's like, did the books change the world? Mm-hmm. Did the theory, you know? I don't know, I'm just drifting off now. Into, how long left?
I think you're, what you're talking about, so there's like that live, you know, like the new black music is this, find the self and kill it, or there's something that like it, that Baraka also says about kind of new black music as being like revenge. It's like sublimated murder. Like they're very grand statements, you know, they're very big statements. It's holding music to high stakes, you know, and that's...
Absolutely. They've got to be made, though, haven't they? Mm. I mean, who am I to say that Baraka should have made those statements in the 60s? But, you know, you've got the passion. It's a passionate response to passionate music and a situation I'm not qualified to talk about, really.
What should we talk about now then instead?
Well, I had one quote actually before we read the poem.
All right, yeah.
And it's a poetess called Gwendolyn Brooks, and I found it in my notebooks around Collective Assemblage of Annunciation. And Gwendolyn Brooks writes this phrase. It says, "We are each other's magnitude and bond." So that's Gwendolyn Brooks, and I see that as you amplify within the ensemble. Mm-hmm. You don't dominate the ensemble, you don't take power. There's an amplification, there's an intensification mm-hmm. through the ensemble.
A bond,
mm-hmm. solidarity forming. Back at the beginning, inexpressible effect creates a bond mm-hmm. between two to try to, or three or four or six or 700. But, a beautiful phrase by her.
Yeah, I think that's really nice to maybe finish on. Should we read the little poem?
Try to, yeah.
Yes, we try and do that.
I'd like to, as long as we're sort of making sure that Nathaniel Mackay and his phrase is mentioned, but I'd also like to mention the name Henry Dumas, a poet. This was an excerpt from a poem of Henry Dumas's called Greatness, and I add it as Appendix 3 to the session on section in Jazz and Organisation. So,
where do we start?
One, two, three.
Each man string
doing his own thing, vibrating at the each to each volume, sounding at the each to each pitch, all being heard at the same time. No one pushing, no one behind, each knowing each's rhythm and sign.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.